Hi, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the long and complex history of the city as a single narrative tale, separated into relatively bite-sized chapters. We are in the early decades of the 14th century and deep into a complex series of events and political arguments rocking London's inhabitants. While we have told the story of the city over 76 hours of narrative broken into 114 previous chapters, for the last three of them I've been trying to explain away the tumultuous years of the end of the reign of Edward I and the start of the reign of Edward II and the incredibly complex events this triggered in London. It's a tale of personal politics and of a city as complicated and as sophisticated as London is today. Nothing was ever simple. It was a story about how economics drives politics and how politics sees factions or parties forming because of them. And it's about how natives coped with foreigners, both European and people from beyond the walls of the city. And now we've reached part four of this tale. So, politically, the radically inclined mayor, John de Guisors III, had just forged an unlikely alliance with Alderman William de Leyer, the conservative leader of the richer, more prudent elements of the city's body politic. De Leyer was a pepperer, these were the rich dealers in spices, and he had formed this union with Mayor de Guisors to limit the fractious and raucous elements of the working poor of the city. De Guisors now supported a more cautious approach to the national politics, and De Leyer lent the mayor support for moves against foreign rivals within London. And the pair of them seemed to have gotten in with the ruling government clique at the time, the Lords Ordainers. But ultimately, trade was behind all of this, the trade in wool. About half of England's wool was being exported from the docks of the city, and wealthier Londoners are trying desperately to gain their share of the money this generated. But rich foreign merchants could respond because they could get the king's ear, and this was a king engaged in a rivalry with the Lords Ordainers, and both sides wanted London to support them. And on its streets, the working poor now had uniforms, liveries, denoting their allegiance to their crafts and their willingness to work as a unified body to bring force of numbers to any debate, or force of numbers to any fight if need be. This is the London that was to try and navigate the stormy waters ahead. So welcome then to the 115th chapter of The Story of London, covering the years 1316 until 1321. And this is the fourth part of the story within a story, covering the birth of the great guilds of London, the livery companies of the city. Welcome then to the Serpent's Eiter. We begin in 1316. As I covered in the last chapter and just mentioned there, the Port of London was now exporting about one half of the nation's wool from its docks, and the protection which the citizens had gained from the Lords Ordainer meant that they, rather than the foreign merchants, were beginning to start carrying it all. The Londoners who dealt with spices and dyes could now capitalise upon their high profit margins and jump in and start getting into the business of exporting wool for even greater profits. But as some may have guessed, this is me simplifying the complexity of trade in the city. And I'm about to offer an even more terrible simplification, which I hope will help listeners grasp what's just about to happen. London was suddenly the focus of the wool trade because of where the wool was going. It was being shipped in convoy from London to the French port of Saint-Omer. This was designated the wool staple, aka the compulsory market where English wool had to be sold. However, across the channel there were rivals to Saint-Omer. Bruges and the ports of the Duchy of Flanders had long been the principal destination for exports of English wool, and the Flemish wanted it to regain that status. But the nearby port of Antwerp in the Duchy of Brabant also wanted that trade, and the Brabanters were also agitating for it. As well as this, within London, the Italian merchants, who had come to dominate trade in London, were competing to maintain their share of business, and the German merchants who owned the steel yard down by the River Thames were agitating also for the same, and both of these had an interest in where the wool staple ended up. So with all the political nonsense going on in London right now, it's worth keeping in mind that there were economic shenanigans going on at the same time, and this would drive things as economics then as now drives politics. The rivalries between London-based merchants and foreign ones was growing, as the commercial protection London had regained from the Lords Ordainers and the new opportunities presented by the staple made the younger merchants more ambitious to compete rather than passively cooperate with the foreigners, especially as Italians showed no willingness to respect the franchise of London. And yet, given everything, it is ironic to say that no sooner had these new opportunities come up when suddenly they were under threat. Wool exports suddenly fell and the money supply began to tighten. To judge from the low yield on the tax of movables in 1316, the city's economy was suffering from a shortage of coin again. In fact, the coin struck in London Mint between October 1315 and September 1316 shrank to a negligible amount, and mercantile credit shrank with it. The diminishing money supply inevitably bred alarm to the shopkeepers and merchants on Soper's Lane. The entire pepperers profession in London saw that in the face of foreign rivalry and this economic problems, it was time to close ranks against the outsiders. But that lane was to emerge as arguably the most important of London's commercial districts right now. Two men with shops on it, Simon Corp and John de Burford, the leader of the Soper's Lane pepperers, realised formal organisation was the way to go in the current economic climate. They realised what they needed from the city authorities and from the Lords Ordainers was to be able to secure control of the distributive trade on which both their export and import trades depended. They needed formal recognition for the status of their informal trade association. Recognition of their authority over its trade depended on the city registering its ordinances. In May 1316, Alderman Simon Corp secured this formal recognition for his fellow pepperers of Soper's Lane. They gained a formal charter, and with it, a monopoly for themselves. The names of the 21 men who submitted their ordinances for registration in 1316 showed that the group was dominated by men of wealth and influence. William de Leyer did hold out, but six of the members, John de Burford, Simon Corp, William de Furness, William Walron, Ralph de Balancer, and William de Biddick, had been amongst those who'd been asked by the king in 1312 to keep the city safe for him, which I mentioned last chapter. And even though it may seem like the merchants who dealt in spices are all coming together, a closer examination of who was involved show deep city-based divisions. Of the 21 pepperers who signed the ordinances, only two of them paid taxes in Cheap Ward. All the others were residents of Cordwainer Ward, which covered most of Soper's Lane. It's clear that the organisers of the ordinances in 1316 were the richest merchants who were most connected with the export, import and distributive trade of the pepperers. The class of small retailers in pepper was divided in its allegiances, while the apocryphes of Cheapside were not invited at all to join. The rules and regulations of the new guild reflected the enduring interest of the pepperers in the purity and true weight of the spices they sold. The mixing of old and new spices, or those of differing quality, was completely forbidden. Frauds were condemned, such as the moistening of spices to increase their weight, and the disguising of bales, so that goods of better quality appeared at the ends to deceive the purchaser. Finally, the trade reiterated the agreement about weights, which Thomas Romaine had made in 1309. The rules of this new body appeared to try not to be controversial. But from the point of view of the apocryphes and spices on Cheapside and the ropers of Dowgate, the registration by the mayor and aldermen of this group suggested a disturbing claim to control the retail and distributive trade by the pepperers of Soper's Lane. Ultimately, the reason why the pepperers were successful in asserting this claim was because partly they were more willing to cooperate with the Lords Ordainers, partly they were willing to work with the major mercantile associations in defence of the franchise and of the choice of staple, and also what helped was between 1315 and 1317, the wool staple was moved from Saint-Omer to Antwerp in Brabant. Now, that move had been necessary because war had broken out between the French and Flanders, and the Flemings were therefore unable to go to Saint-Omer to buy wool. So, it moved, and Londoners began exploiting the situation. William de Biddick was one notable pepperer who exported wool to Antwerp in 1316. The Mercers probably gained most from this change. The cheaper part of their range of goods included canvas and the linen cloths manufactured in Brabant. Furthermore, they were already searching overseas for markets for English cloth. The manufacturers of the new cheap Norfolk worsteds had established close links with the London Mercers, to whom they sold their products and actually sent apprentices and immigrants to swell their numbers. So it's clear from the tax payments of 1315 that Londoners were exporting English cloth overseas, and therefore they benefited from the transfer of the wool staple to Antwerp, where the Duke of Brabant was seeking to attract any foreign trade. The move meant that the Mercers could export both wool and cloth to Antwerp and buy there the imports of linen, which were the mainstay of their distributive trade. The unity of the city at this moment behind the Ordainers was prompted also by the common interests of the Pepperers and the Mercers in resisting the extension of Venetian seaborne commerce in London. Before this moment, it was mostly the Genoese who had dominated Italian trade by sea, and their cargoes were restricted mainly to spices, dyes and alum. The rich velvet satins and damasks, which the Mercers dealt in, were carried by the Venetians over land and could have been bought in Antwerp or in Bruges. But in 1315, the first Venetian galley was sent to Bruges, and a year later, a Venetian dromund was given safe conduct to trade with England. Its object was to sell luxury imports in return for cargoes of wool to export directly to Italy. By 1319, a Venetian dromund was bringing into London £10,000 worth of sugar and £1,000 worth of candy. This cargo was then sold in London, and the proceeds were taken to Boston and invested in wool for Flanders. If this seaborne trade of the Venetians were to expand, the developing overseas trade of the Pepperers and the Mercers would dwindle away, since it depended on their ability to purchase Italian goods in Flanders or Brabant. So, for the time being, the Pepperers, including this newly organised guild faction based on Soper's Lane, the Mercers and others found harmony and mutual support in adhering to the cause of the Lords Ordainers, who promised them protection both for their franchise and the staple against the foreigners and the grasping policies of the court. So you have conservative and radical elements coming together to run the Alderman Court of London under Mayor de Guisors and Alderman de Layer, and you had merchants, rich pepperers and others uniting to resist Italian domination of the wool trade. And if you want proof, I mean, two pepperers were elected as sheriffs of London in this era. However, this newfound equilibrium was utterly disturbed in 1317 by a random, uncontrollable event. The weather had turned bad for a few years. Climatologists suggest that there was an increase in climatic variability over these years. There is some suggestion of an increase in extreme events, including huge storms, and that evidence that, as well as excessively damp conditions, temperatures were depressed. Or, in layman's terms, it became very cold, very wet, and very windy for a few years. The exceptionally wet year of 1315 is said to have been the one where the idea that if it rained on St. Swithin's Day, it would rain for 40 days and nights originated from. All of this extremely bad weather began to cause crop failures. By 1317, the crop failures and food shortages manifested themselves with the arrival of a famine. There were said to be several famines thought to have occurred during these years. At least one historian claims that the famine of 1316 and 1317 was probably the last really severe famine in English history. Another historian estimates that over these 2 years, approximately 500,000 people died of causes related to it, which, if it's true, represents about 10% of the population of England. A famine that killed 1 in 10. Yep, that's pretty horrendous. Moreover, the famine which befell England and several parts of Europe in the years between 1315 and 1318 overwhelmed the powers that be of the land. For three successive seasons, torrential rains ruined the crops and the seeds rotted in the soil. Disease also struck down flocks and herds. The price of wheat in London more than doubled in 1316 to 1317. A great many people may have died from starvation, and in many areas the rural economy was devastated. The high cost of food and the loss of population reduced the demand for other goods, and customs revenue fell by a third. The ruling class of England, the king and his nobles, honestly do not seem to care or even be bothered, but in London they knew all about it. As usual, steps were taken to mitigate it. The import of foodstuffs from the continent was started, but London was triggered by this event starting the following year. The political strife and turmoil, which is about to break out afresh in London from 1318 onwards, has to be seen against this background of a deepening commercial depression caused initially by the famine and then perpetuated by the monetary crisis. It revealed itself in renewed hostility to the foreigners, who were blamed for importing inferior coin. So, the staple returned from Antwerp to Saint-Omer in 1317. Some merchants then avoided it and continued to take their wool to Brabant. The Brabanters were only too willing to allow wool export directly from England to their home ports. The return of the staple to Saint-Omer now created a fresh division of interest between London's mercantile groups and between the pepperers themselves. One of the reasons, simply, the manipulation on Europe of the relative values of foreign currencies affected the price of which English exports sold overseas. And this meant English merchants decided to take payments in goods instead of in coins. This had two immediate effects. It perpetuated the monetary crisis at home by threatening an adverse balance of payments, and it meant that the location of the overseas staple became doubly important to the exporters of wool because it determined how easily they could remit their profits through the importing of goods in which they specialised as either retailers or distributors. The mercers and the ropers who sold linen and canvas imported from Brabant lost loads because of the move back to Saint-Omer. The mercers especially were howling because of the decision made by the Venetians in 1318 to make Antwerp their commercial headquarters, because this opened the possibility of buying Venetian goods there at wholesale prices to sell retail in London. When the staple was moved from Antwerp, they also lost their two-way trade in exporting wool and importing in return the linens they sold retail in England. The Saint-Omer staple offered them none of the profits of such trade and instead handed them over to the Brabanters. Their best hope of combating the new privilege given to the Brabanters was supporting home staples, a staple located in England. These would force the Venetians and the Brabanters to sell their imports to them and such a staple, and hey, why don't we make that London? Meanwhile, the fishmongers and the skinners, who dealt in Hanseatic imports, and Hanseatic was the name given to the Germans in the steel yard and other merchants from the Baltic region, they also lost trade as a result of the moving of the staple to Saint-Omer. Inevitably, they lost their import trade from Antwerp, while the new staple deterred the Hansards from visiting England to buy wool, since they were obliged to take it to the French town instead of directly to London. This explains the catastrophic fall in the amount of wax imported by these foreigners into London after 1316. The fishmongers and the skinners, therefore, joined the clamour for home staples in the belief that they would attract the Germans back to England while not impeding their own export trade to Antwerp. Middlemen of almost every trading interest in the city, including several of the pepperers, joined them in calling for home staples because they made the middlemen the essential link between the wool producers and the foreign exporters. A staple overseas cut out the middlemen because it encouraged English exporters to make direct contact with the wool producers. The Vinters, on the other hand, and a group of pepperers led by John de Greatham, were keen to keep the overseas staple at Saint-Omer. See, it was the centre of the wine trade, And when the staple moved there, the number of vintners involved in the wool trade then almost doubled because they were making more cash. Some other pepperers also joined John de Graytham in importing wine from Saint-Omer. Wine was viewed as less of a luxury than spices, and its market was more certain, however. The more prominent wine importer amongst the pepperers was Benedict de Fulsom, who was already engaged in the trade when he paid a modest tax in Cordwain in 1319. But he soon made quite a bit of money from this, to the point where he was eventually made the king's butler. Whereas pepperers such as Fulsom and Grantham welcomed an overseas staple if it was in Saint-Omer, their interest in the wine trade made them less sympathetic, with demands that it should be moved back. But while all this was going on in London, however, across the rest of the country, there was no mistaking the fact that the years of domination of English politics by the Lords Ordainers had been a time of suffering and humiliation for the nation. Some villagers may have lost up to a fifth of the population. Fear of not having enough coin to pay for food or rent made people react by hoarding it, particularly in the towns. This may explain why there was a startling increase during the 1320s in the number and size of Londoners' bequests of cash. Small tradesmen all over the kingdom had insufficient coin to buy from the importers. The years of famine and high taxation, followed by the disastrous fall in the output of mints, forced them to reduce their purchases. The pepperers responded, as they might do in similar cases in the future, by reducing their investment in trade. Either they hoarded the money in order to lend it at high interest on good security at a future date, or they invested it for safety into London property. In 1318, the main tensions in the pepperers' trade were between the older generation of men then, such as William de Layer and Simon Corp, who had made their money mostly as middlemen and distributors cooperating with the foreigners, and the younger generation of entrepreneurs, led by John de Grantham, who were discovering the profits of a two-way trade provided that a policy for the staple was operated in their interests. All of this and all of the tensions going on need not have created an open conflict between the pepperers or between the different trade associations if the Crown had not sought to exploit the rival interests of London's mercantile groups for their own ends. The Londoners were agreed, at least, that a staple, whether one at home or overseas, should be enforced, and that foreigners such as the Bardi should not be allowed to evade it. No, London was disagreeing with itself, but it was not disagreeing with themselves badly. But in 1318... they were dealing with a court and a government which had come under the influence of a new royal favourite, Hugh de Spencer the Younger, the son of an old supporter of the king, also called Hugh de Spencer. He was called the Elder. Hugh de Spencer the Younger was not just some royal favourite. Vicarious, unscrupulous, subtle and cunning, the younger de Spencer was a serpent of a man, a master manipulator, and a brilliant political operative. By the autumn of 1318, he had gained an ascendancy over royal policy and was bent on securing his position by re-establishing the power of the crown. To do this, he believed it was essential to gain control of London and to purge its councils of all those who had supported the Lords Ordainers. And Hugh de Spencer decided that the best and easiest way to do this was to turn London against itself. He began combining offering incentives and support to the younger generations of ambitious merchants, while also stirring up discontents amongst London's populace against the ruling group of aldermen who had supported the Ordainers. To this end, he set out to cultivate a faction who had the most to gain from royal favour, and which had shown back in 1312 and 1313 that it could manipulate popular disaffection in London with great skill. This faction was led by three mercers, one of whom, John de Charlton, had just been elected mayor of the staple or head of the London wool exporters. The other two were Charlton's fellow mercers, Alderman Hamo Goodcheap, and the demagogue and great agitator of 1312-13, William de Hackford. These three joined forces with another faction whose members were fishmongers, skinners and ropers. All of them depended on the steelyard's imports from the Baltic, which had been disrupted by moving the staple to Saint-Omer. Their leaders were the alderman fishmonger Hamo de Chigwell and his close associate Roger de Palma. Their link with the Mercers was that they had all benefited from the Antwerp staple. This had allowed them to take over much of their own import trade, and they'd also began to export to Antwerp English cloth as well as wool. All the members of this faction wanted the staple to return there. Failing that, like the Mercers, they supported home staples, of which London would be their preferred choice. These at least would bring the Germans back and protect their own distributive trade. Edward II, now acting through his brilliant agent Hugh de Spencer, could therefore offer these factions support for their choice of staple if they would give de Spencer their political support. The serpent whispered and was ready to strike at London. The first step was to go after the ruling group in the city who had thrown in their lot with the Lord's Ordainers. Many of them were the drapers who supported a staple in Bruges. In February 1319, the barons of the Exchequer were sent to Guildhall to investigate the city's government, and the populace was encouraged to complain of any abuses they knew had taken place in the years previously. There can be little doubt from the eventual outcome that de Spencer's men tapped William Hackford and his radical mercers. The campaign of popular protests against the ruling group of aldermen, who included the Pepperers William de Layer and Simon Corr, bear all the marks of a skilled political organisation, of somebody who was good at organising, quote, conventicles and associations, unquote. Hackford's hands are all over this. And these protests coincided with and can hardly have been uninfluenced by the summons issued that month for an assembly of wool merchants which was to decide on the policy towards the wool staple. And this was all time to happen with the election of London's members of a new parliament. Now, the choice of William de Layer as one of the city's MPs for that parliament shows that the old ruling group still dominated the court of aldermen at the end of March 1319. However, the Assembly of Wool Merchants came out decisively on the 24th of April in favour of setting up two home staples, one north and one south of the River Trent, that one being at London. It must be assumed that London's wool merchants played a dominant role in this decision, and it signified the ascendancy over them of the mercer John de Carlton and his allies. The city's records do not reveal what was going on in its narrow streets and crowded ward meetings in that spring of 1319, but subsequent events suggest that Hackford and his cabal gained political ascendancy because of their links to Hugh de Spencer, enabled them to hold out to the commonalty the prospect of obtaining a favourable royal charter in return for their political support. And you see that on the 7th of May, when the city sent a letter to the king under its common seal annulling the election of William de Layer as their MP and notifying their choice in his stead, William de Hackford and four others to attend the Parliament in York. And on the 21st of May, Hackford and the Recorder of London left, but they were entrusted with 1,000 marks of silver, which they were to take to the king as a loan for the war with Scotland he was pursuing. They also took with them to York a new draft charter of the city, which was confirmed by the king on the 8th of June. So not only was a new political faction taking over in London to aid them, they created a new set of rules for the city. The charter of 1319 has been described as revolutionary and as representing, and I quote, the highest peak of achievement that a popular movement ever attained in medieval London, unquote. It certainly contained a startling feature that the aldermen were to be removed and re-elected annually, and they were not allowed to hold a second consecutive term. According to that charter, all the city's executive officers, the common clerk, the common sergeant, the city's chamberlain, were to be elected by the commonalty and could be removed at will. The city's taxes were to be controlled by four auditors elected by the commonality, and the aldermen were to be taxed as other citizens were. Together with the restrictions on aldermanic power went measures to protect the city's trade against all outsiders. Foreigners were only to be admitted to the franchise with the consent of six men from a craft or trade they wished to practice, and they were to take a full share of all civic duties and taxes if they were allowed in. The ban on non-citizens taking part in the retail trade was emphasised and was to be enforced by annual inquiries. Any citizen found to have covered the goods of a non-citizen, that is, pretending they were his own, were to be expelled from the franchise. Foreigners could only stay for 40 days in the city and were always to lodge with citizen hosts. In short, this looks like a win for the radical factions who've been looking to regain London's power. But that's the whole point. It was a regaining of rights that had dated all the way back to Anglo-Saxon times. In truth, the only feature of the charter that could be seen as revolutionary was the annual election of the aldermen, and that was never even partly enforced. In fact, the most enduring features of the Charter of 1319 was that which gave the individual trade associations the power of admitting men to citizenship. Not quite guilds like the Pepperers and Soapers Lane, but moving close to it. As a consequence, any newcomer to London, foreign or domestic, who sought citizenship of the city had to identify themselves with a particular association and accept its discipline. In truth, the main purpose of this rule seems to have been control the aliens, and as if to emphasise this objective, its granting was followed by attacks on the street and robberies of any Lombards or northern Italians found in the city. And if we're going to be honest, the annual election of aldermen wasn't a revolution at all. The purpose of the Charter of 1319 was not to transfer political power to the commonality. The elections clause was introduced because it was intended to displace the aldermen who would be opposition to the new pro-dispenser group. Indeed, when you think about it, the new charter had measures in it that limited royal power. And these could only have been obtained as part of a bargain that Dispenser had made to gain support in London. The appeal of the charter to Hackford's mercers and other middlemen was obvious, as were the measures taken to make taxation more equitable. The trade associations gained a veto over admission to the city and therefore had some control over their manufacturing and retail interests. But the merchants themselves remained free to import or export whatever goods they chose. So the Charter of 1319, therefore, achieved no craft revolution, but it didn't seek out to achieve one. It won for London's middlemen and retailers additional protection from foreigners and outsiders as part of a political deal, which allowed the Crown to meddle in and manipulate the city for its own ends and to use the rivalries of London's mercantile groups over the staple to achieve their aims. Hugh Dispenser's first aim now was to make his supporters the dominant group in the Court of Aldermen. This was the purpose for the new provision for annual elections. Between October 1319 and October 1321, the new political faction began a purge. Five drapers were replaced as aldermen by four mercers and one roper, while three pepperers were replaced by two skinners and one vintner. The mayors of the ordainers' ascendancy were also removed from their aldermanies. The men who replaced them included John de Burford and a new generation of Pepperers, who, like the rest of Dispenser's supporters, were impatient with the conservative policies of the elder generation. Pepperers, like John de Greatham, were chosen as sheriff in September 1322, and he was followed into the office by another new generation Pepperer, Adam de Salisbury, and then by a third new generation Pepperer, Benedict de Fulsom, by 1324. The process by which Dispenser's men consolidated their power began with the election of Hamo de Chigwell as mayor in October 1319. Opposition was expected because the king sent a writ to the city banning, quote, the bringing of offensive weapons likely to provoke disturbances in the city, unquote, but there does not seem to have been violence as he took power. The previous May, William Savant had been the first of the established Alderman Pepperers to fall victim to an alliance of mercers, skinners and fishmongers. He is replaced as alderman of Walbrook Ward by John de Cotton, a skinner. As a foreigner and close associate of the Italian, Savant was an easy political target. William de Leia and his associates must have realised that they could only safeguard their position by bidding for favour from the king. And it's possible they hoped to do this by inflating the assessments of tax on movables which the city had to pay the king that autumn. Certainly, this was the chief accusation made against them later, and the Chronicle reported violent demonstrations at Guildhall in November 1319 against secret increases in the tax assessments. Mayor Chigwell promptly forwarded a petition in which the city complained of the exactions of tax commissioners and prayed for redress and for the maintenance of the franchise. As a consequence, William de Leia and three associates were removed from their aldermanies in January 1320 and replaced by Chigwell supporters, who included Roger de Palmer. At the same time, Andrew Horne, Chigwell's fellow fishmonger, was elected to the important post of city's chamberlain. The tax was reassessed on the king's orders. But it seems that from some accusations that came out the next year, that a group of five men, led by William de Hackford and including the spy Sir Walter Grost, then used this reassessment of the tax to punish those who opposed them. The sums collected from the wards suggest that the Mercer's stronghold of Cheap was taxed lightly at £57.06.04, as was the fishmonger's stronghold in Bridge Ward at £41.09.04. By contrast, Simon Corp's ward of Cordwainer had to pay £73.15 and John de Guise's Vintry ward £94.10.11. Meanwhile, the proposal for a home staple failed to get royal assent, probably because of the opposition by the foreign merchants, and also possibly because of influence from the drapers. Charlton and his fellow mercer, Alderman Hamo Goodcheap, then began from December 1319 to prosecute, with the Crown's assent, those wool exporters who had evaded the staple in Saint-Omer. This had the merit of winning widespread support amongst the wool merchants because it restricted foreigners' freedom of trade. It also gave Charlton and the mercers a chance to dispose of some more of the opposition. But these prosecutions were only possible with the support of the Crown, and that support had to be paid for. It should come as no surprise that in February 1320, William de Hackford was highest contributor amongst a group mainly of mercers, skinners, ropers and fishmongers who raised money for presents which were given to the king and the court when they returned to London from York. In this group of Chigwell supporters were the spicer Walter Grost, who had already been associated with Hackford, and the two pepperers Adam de Salisbury and Thomas de Enfield. The divisions and dissensions were clearly spreading amongst the good folk of Soper's Lane. London was witnessing a whole-scale political war, with Mayor Chigwell purging his opposition. When the King came to London in August 1320, he was met by the Mayor and the citizens, eager to welcome him and now wearing their craft liveries. The mercers, skinners, fishmongers could feel confident that with Despenser behind them, their trade associations were powers in the city, and the leaders were able to win for them the protection and policies they needed to flourish. The vintners and drapers became keenly aware too, as a consequence of the political struggles, that they too needed the power of an organised trade group to protect their commercial interests. For these bodies, the symbol of solidarity and strength, a uniform or livery, was an outward display of unity and power. The pepperers, by contrast, had no common livery or other sign of a disciplined and organised trade. Not only was their retail trade depressed, but their involvement of their leading merchants in the wool trade had brought them into conflict with their newly formed association on Soper's Lane, which reflected conflicts both within the city and the kingdom. The only thing that was clear to all the contestants in the summer of 1320, when the court returned to London, was that the power of the crown was once more an ascendant, and that the man who directed that power was Hugh de Spencer. In October 1320, there was a change in mayor, as the charter of 1319 had dictated, but the elderly goldsmith, Nicholas de Farndon, seems to have been put in the mayor's chair merely to hold it for the return of Chigwell. Hackford's group remained prominent in the council of the city, and a fishmonger and a vintner were elected sheriffs. And it was at this point that Hugh de Spencer seems to have decided that the Crown Party had secured enough base for him to throw off the mask and proceed to subjugate the city by the crown directly. Finally, the serpent struck. Up until now, he had relied on Chigwell, Carlton and Hackford to remove from office all those who had supported the Ordainers. Now he intended to control London without the help of anyone. And his method to do this was to use an ITER, a visitation by the royal justices to probe and inquire into every aspect of the city's life and government. Any reading of the situation can see that Hugh de Spencer's intention was to set up an inquisition to investigate any wrongdoing in the city and to set faction against faction and create conditions so volatile it would justify him taking the city into the king's hand. A simple plan, but brilliant. The ITER began at the Tower of London on the 14th of January 1321, and it lasted more than 24 weeks. And the chroniclers at the time all agree that it was the most intimidating that London had ever faced. Each ward was ordered to make its complaints to the justices, and Mayor Chigwell seems to have gone along with it at first. He thought its purpose would enable his faction to destroy the remaining opponents and establish new gains. As such, Chigwell's Wharf of Queenhide and the Fishmongers were prominent in bringing forward charges. Billingsgate and Bridge Ward led the accusations against all the sheriffs who had served under Edward II, apart from those who were Chigwell supporters. Those of them who opposed Chigwell were accused of extorting money and gifts from the fishmongers and of impoverishing them. The Brewers suddenly had a chance to go after Thomas Romaine back when he had been sheriff all those years before. Chigwell's group then followed up this campaign by another onslaught on the four men they had already removed from their aldermanies but were worried could come back into a position of power, one of whom was William de Leyer. They accused them of conspiring to make false accusations and of preventing truth and justice in the city. They were said to have taken bribes and to have assessed taxes and fines unjustly. Leyer and his associates denied the charges but were found guilty. Leyer was fined a large sum of £40. Encouraged by this success, Chigwell's men added the pepperer Simon Corr to the list of those they hoped to destroy. Corr had to pay a fine of 20 marks of silver. Former Mayor John de Guizos III was also found guilty of misconduct as mayor and fined 100 marks of silver. Chigwell was on a roll and the Eater was working for him. But there was then an attempt to attack the draper, Simon de Swanland. He was accused, along with a group of men who had apparently little in common, apart from being less than fervent in their support of Chigwell, of taking part in a conspiracy which met at Plummer's House and in private houses. They were basically accused of conspiring against Mayor Chigwell. Amongst those accused was the Spicer, John de Selling, the Roper, John de Preston, the Pepperer, Richard de Bethemy, and Richard de Reefham, the old opponent of Hackford's militant mercers, and a former mayor, who was named as the leader of the group. However, the judges in the Eater ruled that these men had obviously been organising in order to defend themselves against the persecutions of the more militant members of the city, and the jury found them not guilty of all charges. This encouraged the moderates to unleash a counter-attack upon their opponents. Before the justices, they accused the Spicer Walter Gorst, William de Hackford and three others of conspiring together by mutual oaths to maintain false accusations and to manipulate the elections of mayor and sheriffs and the officials of the city, as well as accusing them of fraud and tax evasion. The extent of this political control which Hackford and Chigwell had by now achieved is shown by the composition of the ward juries which were called to decide these cases. These packed juries made sure that the accusations against Hackford and his associates were dismissed out of hand, and a similar attempt was made to accuse the fishmongers of secret confederacy, but the jury also found them not guilty. But keep in mind, it is doubtful whether the moderates' counterattack could have been launched at all had not the justices in charge of the proceedings been working under Hugh Dispenser's instructions to encourage division in the city amongst all the factions for the purposes of the crown. Dispenser's ultimate aim of taking the city into the king's hand became apparent when all the sheriffs from the time of William de Leyer were summoned before the justices and found guilty of levying fines without a jury. This led to the privileges claimed by the city to be examined and challenged one by one. Finally, the mayor himself was summoned and was accused of exceeding his powers. On the 21st of February, 1321, the goldsmith and mayor, Farndon, was deposed and replaced by a royal warden, a man called Robert de Kendall. The snake played his masterstroke. I mean, it's less than 3 weeks later the Crown used the provisions in the Charter of 1319 to depose four aldermen, Simon Court the Pepperer, John de Guizos the Vintner, Stephen Abingdon the Draper and the Mercer William de Cunston. But during those 3 weeks, Dispenser's supporters had come to realise belatedly after the deposition of the Mayor where in fact Dispenser and the Eiter had been taking them. Led by Chigwell and Hackford, they sought an audience with the King and took with them a letter from the city pleading with him to end the Eater. They had not signed up for this. Hugh Dispenser's attack on London was brilliant. It had turned the city upon itself. It had played men like Mayor Chigwell and the radical Hackford like fiddles. And it would be a masterclass in how you take down a city from within. But London was suddenly saved by events elsewhere. Elsewhere in England, a new baronial revolt had started, led by the Mortimer dynasty. It had broken out in South Wales, but it suddenly changed the balance of power in the country. The king and his new favourite were now having to play defence, and resources could not be wasted maintaining control over London if they had to be used focusing on this greater danger. When the royal justices resumed the eater after the Easter break of 1321, the residents of the city observed sardonically that the justices were now no longer raging like lions, but suddenly seemed as meek as lambs. Hugh de Spencer had to backtrack and turn again to his recently betrayed allies. The royal warden was withdrawn and Chigwell was reappointed mayor in his stead. The resurgent Lords Ordainers were quick to exploit the grievances of the London against the eater and then claimed that evil councillors, aka de Spencer, were forcing merchants to go to St. Omer to sell their wool at great expense. It was a hint that, given the support from London that they needed, the barons might favour a home staple. And this mattered because that fighting elsewhere in the country, it meant that there was an armed force of Ordainers now marching straight for London. The political crisis was far from over. I'm going to end that one there. Hope you can follow it. This is incredibly complex. I understand it, but it's just trying to get about 6 books worth of stuff out to you. I'm trying my best. We're back again next week for another episode. Thanks for listening. Story of London exists as a free podcast. I don't have adverts. I don't think anybody would want to advertise with me, but I don't have any adverts. And as such, it's a passion project. If you can help, you can make a contribution to us. And the reason why we need help is simply because I'm not trying to make a living from this. Chance would be a fine thing. I'm actually just trying to cover the fees to host the podcast and all the music I use. I buy licensed music. I won't steal anybody's music, so I have to cover the fees for that. And these little things are not much, but any contribution you can give can really, really help. You can do that on the Buy Me a Coffee webpage, of which is linked, I think, in the description to this podcast. And beyond that, if you don't fancy doing that, then a nice review or a 5-star rating actually helps, because numbers do move up when I get one of them, because the algorithm goes, oh, I should show this podcast to somebody else. Anyway, you've put up with a lot listening to my voice for this long, so I will let you be. I will see you next week for another episode of The Story of London. Look after yourselves, and if you are in London, hope you enjoy the good weather. Bye.